Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Our guest today is Cameron Steele, a writer, editor, and tarot reader based in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Cameron teaches online creative writing, composition, and literature courses at the University of Nebraska, where she graduated with her PhD in August 2021. Her recent essays are forthcoming or have been published in Gulf Coast, Barrel House, Split Lip Magazine, Brevity, and SFWP Quarterly. She also writes Interruptions, which explores themes of tarot, astrology, literature, and illness in twice-weekly essays, and which was also featured as a Top 100 in Literature newsletter on Substack in 2022. As with all my conversations here, I began this recording by asking Cameron to share a little bit about who she is and where she is in the world. You'll hear our conversation pick up with her response.
The first thought that comes to mind is like, oh fuck, I'm a neurotic bald mom who lives in an overpriced and shitty rental house about 15 minutes outside of a city close to mountains with like really awesome hiking trails that sometimes help ease my anxiety and sometimes don't. But like the less baddie version of that is that I live about 20 minutes outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, on the unceded lands of the Monacan Indian Nation. And I am a mother to a three-year-old and also a writer myself. And I teach at the University of Nebraska online, although I've taught there for 8 years in person. We just moved back to Virginia, where my husband and I are originally from. And I'm also a tarot reader on the side. So sort of where I am and who I am, kind of. I don't know, like the who I am question is so in flux at this point in time because I just finished chemotherapy and a cancer diagnosis round two. And so that question of like who I am, I just feel like I haven't really gotten a grip on it in recent months.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And I'm very excited to talk to you today because I think I found you through Instagram, and to be honest, mm-hmm. I don't remember even how like you first came mm-hmm. across my, you know, line of mm-hmm. sight, but I went into your Substack and immediately joined, and, you know, just the way that you write about your life and all the components of your life, you know, all those pieces that you just mentioned, you kind of, mm-hmm. you touch on all of them, and you write in such a really clear, candid way, with a lot of depth, you know, and I just immediately was like, I have to talk to this person because I just really like your thoughts and, you know, the way you tie things together. So I'm very excited to speak with you about all of this today. And I was thinking that as a way to enter into this conversation, I actually would love to pull a quote of yours from mm-hmm. your essay, No Easy Way Out. Would that be okay if I read that quote?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so you write, I began to read the tarot as an act of desperate attention to my own life. Attention is effort. Attention is negative effort. I began to read the tarot because I was desperate to write. So as a writer myself, I was very curious mm-hmm. to hear you speak a little bit more about that and kind of open that up a little bit.
Yeah. So that essay actually was sort of the title essay of the dissertation that I wrote in 2020 and 2021. And the dissertation was, since I was a creative writing and critical theory PhD student, it was sort of part memoir, part theory about illness. And at that point, I had cancer was on the horizon. I had no idea of anything about that. But so I was really navigating these themes of mental illness and beauty and whiteness and my sort of years-long struggle with bulimia and with self-harm and addiction and all of the things. And so that essay in general and the section you quote here in particular really was attempting to understand. And to be honest, I still don't fully understand how the tarot helped to pull me out of this sort of years-long health and addiction crisis when nothing else really could. Not grad school, not rehab, not getting married to the love of my life, not my therapist. You know, I'm one of those annoying people who have always known what I wanted to do with my life and who I wanted to be, which was to be a writer. I've kept journals since I was old enough to scratch pen across paper. I grew up being recognized for my writing when the toxic, white, wealthy community that I grew up in only really ever, whenever they had time to praise me for something other than, you know, my looks. Mm. And so this is going to be sort of a long answer to your question, but I majored in journalism and creative writing in undergrad. I was an investigative crime reporter in the Deep South for several years out of college. I got my PhD in creative writing with a specialization in women's and gender studies. But what was really weird about this desire of mine to write, to be a writer, is that I kept fucking things up for myself. So I blew up my career as a journalist by virtue of descending into the bulimia and into the self-harm. You know, I spent the first half of grad school drinking myself into a stupor as a way to deal with the anxiety that I had about leaving the house or a bipolar diagnosis. And I'd get better for a while, maybe publish something, manage to teach my classes, and then boom, I'd be back in the therapist's office as she was like signing orders for an inpatient treatment program. Mm. I'd do okay, get out. And then some tragedy, big or small, personal or global, would happen. And I'd use it as an excuse to drop back in into, you know, the bullshit of not eating or binging and purging or medication seeking for benzos and opioids, or, you know, hiding little vodka bottles around their house. And I, you know, and it was just like, I had created this world of pain for myself, for my partner, Kiernan, for my close friends. And I couldn't seem to pull myself out of the vortex of participating in my own self-destruction. And so by 2017, I had all but stopped writing, the thing that I ostensibly loved to do and needed to do more than anything else in the world. So when I came across a deck of tarot cards and a book about how to use them to help with creative work, so art, writing, I was so deeply attached to this self-mythology of being this sick, crazy, bad woman. And I had no sense of how to move forward because I was obsessed with reinscribing the mistakes of my past over and over again into my present. And that foreclosed, you know, any real possibility of a new future. And then I was at the same time, like, very aware that if something didn't change and if I didn't change, I was going to have to quit the PhD program. I was going to blow up this relationship that was so important to me. I wasn't going to really be able to stay alive much longer. So I said to myself, look, I'm going to use these cards and this book to stop drinking and to stop the eating disorder. And then I'm going to use these cards to write. And all of the willpower, because it took a lot of willpower, I had been using to sort of whittling my body down to a certain size or into recovering from hangovers or into sort of teaching through the haze of mental illness, I decided to redirect into reading and studying the tarot and into turning the cards over every day and into staying sober and into doing the writing that I had really ceased for years to do. And it was incredibly hard. I cried a lot. I threw so many temper tantrums, like literally throwing things in our apartment, but I did it one day after another. Just sort of like using the cards to remind myself, like, you know, you are allowed to grow up. Like, you can deal with writer's block. You can deal with your life. You can deal with the fear of opening the front door and going out into the world. You can deal with the fear of the blank screen. So it sounds stupid and cliche, but honestly, everything about my life is a little bit stupid and cliche. But the tarot, I mean, it saved my life. It helped me write my dissertation. It helped me survive pregnancy. in a pandemic with a sick infant. And it's gotten me so far through cancer. And like, I sound like a tarot evangelist, so I try not to talk too much about it to people in my real life unless they ask, but it's undeniably the thing that has helped me to be the person that I want to be in this world for myself and for my family and my friends, for my students, for my writing, which is a long way to say that back to the passage you quoted, you know, I write there that the cards were attention to negative effort because I saw them and I see them as the way of undoing the old stories that I told about myself, about other people, about the larger world. Like staying in the chaos of bulimia and of drunkenness took a lot of work, a lot of effort. And I see the tarot as a kind of anti-effort, a kind of like dark matter of the soul. You know, it requires its own kind of work, but one in the way that I use the cards, at least one that destabilizes like the solipsism of the I or the ego or the self that's only concerned with itself.
I mean, that does not sound stupid in the least. Like that's the last word I would use to describe all of that. And also it's interesting because I think your story, you know, maybe it feels cliche because it's true. Like, and it happens to a lot of people. I think a lot of people come to tarot in these moments of crisis. I mean, mine was different, but not unalike to yours as well. You know, I was going on my own like dark night of the soul journey as well. And I think a lot of people do, you know, and, but I am curious after you shared that story to hear in the midst of all of that, that you were in when you came to tarot, what was the process of getting to know the cards like for you in the midst of all of that? And like, what were the stories that emerged and, you know, just how did that process evolve?
So it was so weird because I mean, one of the things about me is that I have this incredibly like critical mind, and I tend to distrust things that arrive through intuition or dream or, you know, that don't have any sort of like rational grounding. It's just how I've always been. And yet I've also always been one of these people who dreams intensely every night. I have to wake up every morning and write down my dreams because if I don't, like, they will stay with me and they will affect the way I move through the day. So I had this like Rider-Waite-Smith deck and this book, and like you can sort of see one of the shelves behind me as we're talking, but I've always had like my office is just like all books because I didn't really even have very many friends growing up. I just had books. Like I always had this thing where if I grew up to be a hermit in a cave with my teddy bear and my dog and my books, I'd be okay.
Do you remember which tarot book it was that you had?
Yes, it was Jessa Crispin's The Creative Tarot.
Okay.
And Jessa Crispin is a first and foremost a feminist critic and writer. But she, throughout her career, has done tarot and astrology on the side, and she ended up writing this book as a way to help other people in the literary world, like push through writer's block, or I don't know, what's the artist equivalent of writer's block, whatever that is. And so it was a book specifically for like using tarot to help tackle creative problems and the creative process. And I don't remember buying that book, and I don't remember buying the tarot deck because that would have seemed very unlike me at that point in my life. But I was sitting in my little office room surrounded by all of my books, these tomes of feminist theory, like, you know, all of Tolstoy's works, like all of this stuff. And I like look up and I'm so hungover and I'm like weeping a little bit because I'm so disappointed in myself for being hungover again. Just like, I was back in Nebraska at this point, and Nebraska in April is this like smelly time where you can smell the cow shit from the farms all around you. And I'm just sitting there and the light hits this book, this tarot book, and the deck beside it on this high shelf. And like, I don't even remember having it. And I was like, what is that? And I just like got this feeling in my chest, like someone or something or a force outside of myself was showing me something that I needed to see in that moment. And so I was like, oh shit, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna start reading tarot cards. This does not sound like me, but this is what I'm gonna do. And so at first my process was to read Jess's book as if I were reading a memoir. So like I just read the book first without really engaging with the cards, and I was just like so utterly moved by the way she talked about how the cards had changed her own life and had helped her with her writing and all of this stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this too. So I had decided that one of the things that I was going to do, because before I had sort of fallen deep into the miseries that I just described to you, I had always loved being an early riser. Mornings are some of my favorite moments in a day. And I had done that a lot as a reporter. So I was like, I'm going to start getting up early. I'm going to write down my bad dreams and I'm going to turn over the tarot cards. And before I read what anyone says about them, what this book says about them, what anything online says about them, I'm just going to write what comes to mind. I'm going to use these cards as writing prompts, because that was the most important to me. Like, I need to get back into my writing. This is how I survive the world. I mean, this is how I cope with reality. My reality is insufficient. And so I did that. And I remember the first cards I turned over were the Fool and the Ace of Pentacles.
Wow.
And I didn't even know that the Fool was called the Fool. So I, in my journal, I still have it. I wrote the Joker and the Ace of Coins. I just started writing. And so that was the process. I really sort of just worked with the cards on my own as writing prompts, trying to get what I could get from the images. But then I would go back and I would read, I don't know, I'm a writing snob, I'm a reading snob, I have a hard time with a lot of tarot books because I feel like they're not very well written. But Jessica Crispin, all of her books are amazing. Like, I read everything that I could find of hers ever. And then just really marinated in her descriptions of the cards. And because, again, she comes to the tarot and astrology by and through like her own career as a writer. No, astrology actually happened before I even started linking, before I started studying the Golden Dawn, because I got the sense as I was like working with these cards. And then I was like, you know, you're being infiltrated by like what you hear online, and sort of the Chani app was starting to her work with astrology was starting to blow up. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And, you know, in the Creative Tarot in Jess's book, she would write about how like, or not in her book, she had a deck too. I got her deck, and the white book for her deck would link certain cards to certain planets. And I resisted astrology for a while because I was like, I'll never be able to face down my like committee chair or my professors or my colleagues at school if I start saying like I'm doing astrology too. But yeah, I was interested and I started looking into it, and you know, it started aligning with my experiences of myself in the world, the different transits that were happening, like, and where they were happening in my chart. And then it just became this, astrology and tarot together became this rabbit hole I would go down as a way to, you know, keep myself sober, keep myself nourished, be a good partner, be a good teacher, be a writer. And all of a sudden, the insights that I was gleaning from all of these books that I was beginning to read about tarot and astrology began to make its way into the essays and the poems and even the, you know, academic scholarship that I was writing.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I definitely understand that fear of like being taken seriously talking about these things, but also like you enter into a lineage of actually a lot of like academic people who have, you know, gone down this path as well. Like just this morning,
absolutely.
I didn't realize that Margot Adler was like an NPR journalist and like, you know, has that same kind of lineage. And so it's interesting. And I'm curious along those lines, you know, I'm someone that has gone through a lot of different feelings about the way I feel about different like correspondence systems and the way that they were, the way they were created, and really the way that sometimes it's a gatekeeping mechanism, you know, with certain people. So I'm wondering for you, like as someone that does a lot of critical thinking, like in your mm-hmm. life, you know, did you ever feel a pushback against those systems, or is it always just like worked for you, which is totally great too? Or just like, how have you set with that over the years?
Ooh, no, I love this question. And this is one of the reasons I love your work too. And you're an Aquarius moon, just like I am.
Yeah.
So like, yeah. Yes. No, my first way of coming to any of those systems, but even my first way of just like reading the like individual cards in front of me is like always first from a place of criticism. Like, I don't know about this. What are you trying to say? Because I do think that those systems, I mean, they were wielded, right, as ways of keeping certain people in power and keeping certain people out. And so we have to constantly be aware of that and to interrogate that. And I think one of the exciting things about coming to tarot and astrology and coming to really just love and have faith in tarot astrology and as much as I use them as tools and as systems and as languages, is that like I come to it from within this academic tradition that I already kind of hate being within. And so I'm never like wanting to be completely inside of anything, even though I know that I can't necessarily escape tradition, right? Like we're always already inside something, mm-hmm. but then that gives us the exciting opportunity to figure out how we create ways out. Or as you've talked a lot about like sort of the third place, which by the way, all of your work reminds me so much of what Chayla Sandoval is writing about in Methodology of the Oppressed, which is like finding a third voice with which to speak. So like you're speaking from within a system for the purpose of moving outside of it or deconstructing it or taking what you can from it to find another way. And so whenever I'm engaging with like what the Golden Dawn says about, you know, how Gemini it equals the lovers, right? I'm always kind of wondering like, well, but why? Who does that serve? And what sort of meaning can I take from this? But also how might I use this as sort of a starting point for disagreement or for a new way of thinking about this card or a new way of thinking about Gemini or even like a new way of thinking about the role of occult knowledge in the post-war period or the, you know, like you get to sort of like maneuver as you start to learn all of these systems and you get to bend them into new ways of sort of being and doing in the world, which is what I find most exciting about it, right? It's exciting to approach my students as a teacher who's focused on, you know, 21st century narratives of illness and get to sort of shape my lectures according to like the tarot card that I drew for the day. It's exciting for me to approach a tarot reading for a client or a friend or a family member and get to talk to them about the empress, like not as like, you know, motherhood or Venus, but instead as like sickness or what happens like when we don't treat illness as a narrative, right? It's just like you get to sort of work in all these different ways.
Yeah, I feel like that's the next like frontier that I'm like edging against right now is like thinking of those associations or those correspondences that I like the moments where I don't agree with them or just what they are as being mm-hmm. opportunities like for disagreement, which is mm-hmm. like, which is an impetus for like movement in general. You know what
yeah.
I mean? It's like,
yeah.
it doesn't have to be that like I agree or don't disagree. Like that's not far enough. It's like, whatever mm-hmm. it is, whether you agree or disagree, it gets you like moving in a direction, mm-hmm. you know? And like,
right.
that's like, there's a usefulness to that. Like just in and of itself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, both the tarot and astrology operate on the sort of associational logic. They work with an ability to see patterns upon patterns upon patterns within our world. Like that's how, and in my mind, that's how they work. And so when we say like, this, the way like, and not just sort of like ancient systems, but even sort of like the people who are at the forefront of like talking about astrology and teaching it to the public today, like say, like, I don't like agree with the way one of those people consider Saturn or the way the tradition has looked at, you know, sort of Saturn's function. Then I get to like sort of think about why and move mm-hmm. that forward. And again, use that sort of associational logic to create sort of narrative launch points. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. So I have another quote of yours that I would love to kind of dig into now. And I'm going to quote you again here. So you say, quote, "My body was willing to trust in the tarot as a demand that came from elsewhere. And unlike so many other demands from elsewhere, perhaps because of its status as an unsettled and deauthorized mode of knowledge, it became the idiom that has provided me the gift of staying in myself in the years since." And mm-hmm. so kind of along the lines of what we're talking about now, I'm most curious to dig into that unsettled and deauthorized mode of knowledge mm-hmm. and like what you're pointing to there, and just kind of a little bit more about, you know, what you're saying in this quote.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of that quote, the language specifically there from that quote too, is taken directly from my engagement and work with Judith Butler and in her text Parting Ways, where she's talking about, well, how do we talk to the other in a way that like our meaning can be apprehended by a person that we consider other, or in a way that the other face can be actually seen by us instead of sort of like missing each other in the dark. Mm-hmm. And she's specifically talking about the relationship between Israel and Palestine there. And she's sort of building off of theory from Jacques Lacan. But I read that book Parting Ways and I was like, oh, and this is sort of like what I mean. Like I would have read that book if I hadn't been engaged in, you know, my work with the tarot and astrology, I would have read that and been like, this is really moving to me. And that would have been that. But when I read it, I was like, this is exactly what I've done with my life with the tarot. I used it as this sort of language that was not the language of my father. It was not the language of the nuclear family. It was not the language of psychology, or it was not the language of psychiatry. It wasn't the language of critical theory or literature or feminism. It was this other mode of knowledge that, you know, my parents thought was Satanist. My professor mm-hmm. sort of glanced sideways at and thought was deeply insidious. My psychiatrist and my shrink sort of tolerated me talking about it, but they're like, what the fuck is this girl on about? Mm-hmm. And it was like part of the reason why it became so instrumental in changing my life was because it wasn't coming from any of those authority figures, because it was something that was bound up and cast aside. And, you know, like, I know that it wasn't like that for everyone, because I came to the tarot so late. By 2017, like, I mean, like, there were thriving, you know, it was already sort of had emerged in culture as like this memeified poppy thing, but mm-hmm. not to me. And so it was that sort of unsettled and deauthorized sense of it, the fact that it felt almost dangerous, or like the fact that it didn't work rationally. Like I couldn't rationally account for how it came to me or what I was doing with it, or how like I could like, you know, build serious scholarship on top of it, was what made it feel so permanent, which was what it gave like its staying power in terms of like my own personal healing, but also I think in terms of like how it became like a language with which I could also reach other people.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about something that's like just on my mind a lot right now. So I'm in a big learning moment. Like I'm in these two mm-hmm. learning containers, and I'm realizing that in like higher education, which I did not go to college, but I love to learn. Mm-hmm. Like I'm always like reading, you know, and learning. Yeah. And I'm realizing that, you know, when the education system is kind of laid out for us, like, you know, where mm-hmm. we kind of understand what it is to go to these places and study these topics, like there's an implicit trust in that, which, you know, we maybe shouldn't have, but we do, you know, we kind of trust it, you know, but yeah. then when we go on our own learning paths in these, you know, deauthorized places, mm-hmm. it's on, the onus is on us to like vet that knowledge as well, you know, which mm-hmm. adds like a weight, you know, and like, there's a difference between kind of just memorizing something, I think, versus like actually learning it, which to me means that it's actually like changing you in some way, you know?
Right.
And I just wonder what that has been like for you over the years. You know, and if it's deepened, if it started, you know, maybe more shallow and deepened, or just like, you know, if you've gone, how you've waded through that and like how you've learned to trust yourself along this deauthorized path, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Oh yeah. That's a great question. And I don't think I entirely do trust myself. I think well, because it's part of like what you said, like, you know, there's this link between like the learning, but also having to take personal responsibility for that learning and for like trying to figure out like how the pieces fit together, who's saying what their affiliations are, like what the political implications are of everything that you're trying to put together, which can be really hard to unravel. I feel like almost especially in our day and age where it's just sort of information overload and it's really hard to see who people are and what schools of thought things are coming out of, because there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and obfuscation around that, sometimes intentionally. For that process of like, this is like what I want to study and this is how I'm going to sort of embark on this path, I think it's like actually a pretty melancholic and lonely process at times. I mean, it's beautiful. It's amazing. It's scintillating when you stumble upon voices or texts or theories or systems of thought that just sort of light you up and you're like, this is the sentence, or this is the language, or this is the book that I've been searching for my whole life. I mean, it's almost like a love affair, really. But at the same time, like I think that there is a melancholia that goes with it, because there is no one really to sort of tell you when you're going off track. There is no one to sort of, I mean, one of the amazing things about, I mean, everything sucks about higher education, but one of the amazing things about a grad school seminar is when you read stuff, you get to go into a classroom and you get to talk about it together with people. And so I think that doing what you're doing, like doing learning in this sort of unsettled way, sort of in the, you know, back rooms of our lives, it can be really lonely. I don't know, like, what has that process been for you? And like, how do you put sort of like guardrails or like a little lantern to like light the way for yourself?
Well, I appreciate what you just said. I mean, I'm lucky that my husband is incredibly intelligent and also incredibly willing to like talk about these things with me. And and to be honest, I also really credit his Judaism with his willingness to like question things, because it's really tied into the religion, you know, which I didn't know until, you know, we met. And so right from the beginning, he's been so comfortable with me like doing ritual work at home, because also in Judaism, so much of the religion happens like in the home, you know, which is also really interesting. These containers that I'm in now, it's interesting because when I came into tarot, maybe it's because I was earlier in my sort of spiritual questing. And so I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, I guess, to be honest, you know, like it kind of just felt like a fun thing to try, you know? And then as I fell down the rabbit hole, like I got obviously deeper and deeper and deeper. And so now coming into a new practice, which is learning astrology. So I'm learning astrology for the first time. Now I'm asking like all the questions that I've learned I should ask, you know, like, but I'm asking them at the beginning rather than at the end of it, you know? So, and that's something I always think about too, is should we learn the rules to break them, you know, or do we have to learn the rules at all, you know? And, yeah. And then the other class that I'm in is a class on decolonialism, you know, which obviously adds a whole nother layer on top, and really demands a lot of my own pulling the veil back on my own worldviews and my, you know, everything I've kind of known to be true, you know, quote unquote. So it's just a very alchemical time. And I think because of that, I think I'm just feeling a little untethered, you know? So I'm feeling like, cannot, because I guess it's making me doubt my ability to trust myself as much. And mm-hmm. because I'm realizing how much I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. and that just feels really unsettling, you know, which I really feel yeah. it's a great thing. I feel like it's a really positive thing, but it is unsettling as well.
Absolutely. I feel like taking a class on decolonialism at the same time and sort of diving into astrology for the first time must be like, feel like whiplash at times, because astrology as we practice it today and sort of as we inherited it from the Greeks, like, is a colonial project. So that's right. really interesting. Yeah. I feel like that would be so wonderful to have like both of those like learning environments in conversation with each other. And yeah, also incredibly like rug pulled out from underneath you. Like, where do I stand with all of this? Because right. Like, sort of to go back to something you said at the beginning of this, which, you know, we often do find our way to tarot through crises, like that's sort of a typical story. And so then you know, like that becomes what we hold on to, like mm-hmm. the tarot and the spiritual quest, like, and then, but if we're going to sort of do right by ourselves on those quests, we do need to be asking questions constantly. We need to be revising the way we think about deeply held beliefs sort of on down the line for centuries, whether that's sort of like, you know, how we approach the different planetary archetypes or how we sort of approach the symbolism of, you know, pentacles, swords, whatever. Mm-hmm. We have to, yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is, not to like make this about my experience, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
No,
like,
no.
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting is that I feel like right now I'm being simultaneously asked to like lean in more and like just implicitly trust myself more, but also mm-hmm. question everything about myself, you know, like at the same mm-hmm. moment and by the same yeah. people in some ways, like by the same people. So it's like, you know, I keep sort of hearing this message of like, you're like, trust yourself, validate yourself, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. And I actually just finished today a book called Personal Certainty, which is by the same author as Meditations on the Tarot. And that was very helpful because it was really talking about personal certainty being different than collective mm-hmm. certainty, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's where I think I'm at right now with all of it, is like, what am I certain of, including what I'm not certain of, you know, mm-hmm. and how can that be okay? Like, how can sitting into my personal power or my sort of like mm-hmm. knowing include the way that I question, like, how can that be part of mm-hmm. who I am and what I bring mm-hmm. and what I offer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That reminds me of a writing assignment that I give my students. My creative nonfiction students, to sort of, one of the anxieties about being a student writer is they're just like, what do you mean I can write about whatever, like, you know, just like the anxiety of like, what could they possibly say, right? So one of the prompts is like, what I remember is dot dot dot, but then they have to say what I don't remember is dot dot dot, and then they have to write sort of timed for 20 minutes on what they don't remember. Like, how do you write about what you don't remember? And then they say, what I know is, and mm-hmm. they write for 20 minutes about what they know, and then what I don't know is. And so then the rule is they have to keep the pen moving, or they have to keep their fingers sort of tapping away on their keys, and they have to write for 20 minutes about what they don't know. And that sort of sounds like the process you're going through. Mm-hmm. But also this idea of like personal certainty and collective certainty and how they're different. Something that makes me think about is one of my frustrations right now with the tarot, astrology, or just the way the sort of tarot and astrology communities approach topics online, at least sort of in the online discourse, is because we come to astrology and tarot to help deal with crises, with tragedy, with grief, with anxiety, with death, there's a lot of talk about like transcendence or transformation or death as, you know, part of a natural cycle of life, death as an part of the ecosystem, death as, you know, something that leads to rebirth or the ultimate or a transforming life in another way, which is really true on a collective level, right? And it's a comfort on a collective level. But one of the things that sort of this cancer experience has taught me, and just sort of like living in severe illness, is that death is those things. But first and foremost, personally, on a personal level, I know death as fear, right? I know death as paranoia. I know death as grief, as sort of crouching down and having to tell my son that, you know, mommy is going to lose her hair, or mommy can't be hugged right now because she has a port in her chest and it hurts too much to be touched, right? Mm-hmm. So like, and having to hold like what it's like in the body personally to confront something and to know something can be very different from sort of that collective knowledge or the sort of like larger knowledge that is also there too, undergirding the experience. It's really hard. And it's, yeah, untethering is such a good word for that too.
Yeah. I want to talk about that a little bit more. You actually shared today, a new piece that I read, and if it's okay, I want to share a quote. You were talking about, Megan O'Rourke's book, The Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness. You said, I kind of hate the book, actually, though I'm still trying to puzzle out why. It does what a lot of my favorite illness narratives do: raises questions, challenges systems, writes both unflinchingly and metaphorically about pain. So I have not read this book, but I would love to hear you kind of respond a little bit more to that.
Yeah. So, man, you're asking me. I wanted to write this full long book review about that book this week, and I just haven't had time. So I gestured towards it because I'm going to eventually do it a full treatment. So here, let me see if I can get my thoughts together on it. Because the experience of reading O'Rourke's book, and so I should say that my field, my focus for my doctorate is women's narratives of illness. So I've read a lot of illness narratives. It's a genre that I love. It's a genre that I hate. I have like ones that just sort of have saved my life, like Anne Boyer's The Undying or Audre Lorde's The Cancer Journals. I'm using the phrase "save my life" too much in this interview, but there it is. I'm still here. But O'Rourke's book, so I'm reading it last week and I'm like, man, this book should be one that I love because it's brilliantly written. It's beautifully written. It's heartachingly written. And it's about her quest to find doctors who believed her that she was suffering from chronic illness and to help her find a diagnosis. I think the diagnosis was Lyme disease, and then it eventually became something else. But basically she's one of these women, one of these people in America, countless people in America who are living with ambiguous illness where the medical establishment don't really know much about it. They disbelieved that these illnesses were real for a long time. Now they're with long COVID, they're starting to sort of, the establishment is starting to say more strongly, like, yes, Lyme's is real, fibromyalgia is real, POTS is real, like all of these things. So she's like trying to figure out what's going on with her, like why she's in so much pain, why she has so much fatigue, why she can't find help. And I guess sort of the surface level thing that really frustrated me about the book is that it's sort of one tonal register the entire time, which is like, I'm going to perform the noble, sad lady in distress, which, you know what, like, I think I can't stand that because like my impulse is to perform that too, because like, you know, when you've been accused of being a crazy woman because no one understands that, like no one understands your pain, like you want to sort of present as polite and as perfect and as like legible as possible. So I see her striving to do that throughout the book. And yet it annoys me because I want to be like, stop doing that, because it's forcing us all into like continue to perform these boxes of like what it looks like to be a woman in pain. But then the other thing that frustrates me about this book and about really any book that sort of deals with chronic illness is that there's no real accounting for how she makes her living while being sick. Like you have to work, like in the United States, unless you're incredibly well off, you have to work while you're sort of on your deathbed. And she sort of gestures at why she doesn't have to do that or what she's sort of doing. Like, and in the end, you know, she's just like a wealthy white woman, like with, you know, with, you know, family wealth and spousal wealth and like a ton of resources at her disposal. And like, I wanted her to engage much more with that. Like, her life is so miserable and so hard and yet so lucky at the same time. And there's sort of no sense of that in the book. And I just was like, oh, come on.
Yeah. Thank you for answering that. And maybe by the time this interview comes out, you will have written the full, you know, treatment of of your response. So yeah. So I want to hear, before we wrap up, I really would love to hear about working with tarot through illness and what that's been like for you. Because this is a question that people ask a lot is, you know, is it okay if there are times where I don't go to my cards, or, you know, are there topics that we shouldn't go to our cards about, you know, or just the sensitiveness of that. And I can see how, I can see both ways. I can see how it could be helpful, but I could also see how it might be kind of scary. You know, like I mean, in my own way, like I've had moments where I've gone to my deck and been like, I don't know if I really want to pull a card about this or not, you know? So yeah. What has that been like for you? What's kept you working with the tarot through that, you know, and just a little bit more about that. I would love to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe the best way to talk about it would be to tell you when I am too afraid to go to the tarot and when I'm not. And so the tarot and astrology for me, for my cancer, without a doubt have gotten me through the grief and illness, because I go to the tarot and to astrology specifically because I want it to describe to me my grief and illness. Like, I'm not looking for comfort when I go. I'm looking for a reflection of what feels like an indescribable circumstance in my life. You know, illness narratives love to quote the philosopher Elaine Scarry saying that pain destroys language. But I feel lucky that I've never felt that way. Like, no matter whether I was, you know, waking up after having my breast amputated or whether I was sort of biting my lip through chemo infusions, I knew that I could find words to describe those experiences, even if those words were Five of Cups or Mars retrograde in the seventh house, or, you know, Pluto on top of my sun, now on top of my moon, right? Like, that was language for pain for me. And so it was really affirming in that way. Where I get scared about going to the tarot, I can't really avoid astrology because I just fucking know it now. is when it comes to, when it comes to my baby. I mean, he's not a baby, he's three. When it comes to my son, Theo, my son, who is sort of a character in the ongoing cast of my newsletter, he was very sick the first year of his life, where he could not eat. He could not keep down breast milk. He could not keep down formula. He could not keep down prescription formula. Like, and this was during the pandemic, during lockdown. And my husband and I were watching him just like shrink and shrink and shrink, like, you know, like not grow, but like basically he was turning into a shriveled fruit in front of our eyes, and no one could tell us what was wrong with him. And he was sort of on schedule to be hospitalized and to have an eating tube put in his stomach. And in those moments, I could not in good conscience turn over a tarot card, because what would I have done if the tarot had like given me death? Or even the Five of Cups or the Tower. Like, I think, like, as you know, it is fine for me to imagine my own death. Like, I can't go there with his yet.
So
I couldn't do that. But where astrology was helpful for me during that experience is that I knew my baby's chart. I knew that he had a Virgo moon, in a tight opposition with Neptune. I knew that he was born under the sun, Saturn, Pluto conjunction in Capricorn. Like, I knew these things about his chart, which led me to ask questions, which led me to a medical expert outside of the country that helped him to get better in a way that the US doctors could not without surgical intervention. So, Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, that what you were describing of like when it's your experience, you know, you know your experience, but like when it's outside of you, it's a whole different thing, you know, like,
Yeah. I mean, like, would it be harder for you, like, you know, to ask the tarot, like, tell you like hard stuff about your husband. I feel like it would be harder to sit with that than like to ask questions about yourself.
Because to outsource that in that way, it also is different because like when it's about yourself, it usually is, like you said, more reflective or more like internally searching versus like outside of you. It's kind of bringing in like a more like fate or like more, you know, just kind of like more of like more predictive, I guess, in a way, or more, you know, because there's only so much you can really know about something that's outside of you versus something that's like inside of you, you know? So,
yeah. And whereas like you can use like, you know, I could use the tarot on mornings before I had to go in to get chemo to sort of prepare myself for what that experience might be like. But, you know, I couldn't use the tarot to help me really prepare for what was already an excruciating reality dealing with, you know, a sick child. So,
right.
I mean, I guess I could have, but like my mind and my heart couldn't really go there.
Yeah. So before I ask you my last question, I just wanted to see if there was anything else that, you know, is on your mind that you would like to talk about in any way or bring up in any way, or expound on anything that we've talked about already, anything like that?
Yeah, well, I've been, really interested in the name of your podcast, and in the name of your work, In Search of Tarot. Just like rhetorically, that's really interesting because tarot is there, and like this idea of searching for it, I don't know, has opened up a lot of like possibilities in my mind. So I was wondering like how you came to that name, like what that means for you.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, like people ask me that and it's sort of like your story about finding or working with tarot. I don't remember how I came up with it, if I'm honest. Like I don't remember the moment where it came into my mind. We just, you know, at the time it was my friend Erica when we launched the podcast, and we just launched it. And then, but then it like grew in meaning over the years and just kept feeling like more and more right. You know, I mean, I definitely am someone that is always on a search, you know, and I think I like how you're framing it because now I think of searching for tarot in a lot of different ways. I think of it as searching for like the history of it, which is kind of an impossible quest, you know, never-ending quest. Yeah. But then also searching for the meaning of it or searching for the reason to use it or just what it is. I mean, you know, like it just kind of keeps getting deeper and deeper. And every time I've launched something, I've been like, I'm just going to call it In Search of Tarot. Like it just keeps feeling like, right. You know? But that's actually a perfect segue for my last question for you, which is there something that you're kind of in search of right now in your life?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, you know, it feels like an impossible question to answer because there are so many answers. And I'm a Sagittarizing, so that's one of the reasons why I love the name. I'm like, yeah, I can get behind that, but probably like on a micro level, just to get some sleep because I don't sleep well. I never have, but sort of on a macro level, just like, I don't know. I'm like constantly thinking about community. I know that we all are. For me, like I'm just like constantly thinking about like how do I find a community within which to raise my son so that if I do die sooner rather than later, he and my husband will feel like held and cared for and also given space to hold and to care for and to love the world, you know, sort of in the wake of that. So that's sort of what I'm always thinking about.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I want to let people find you. If you could share the best way for them to follow you and to follow your work.
Yeah. So, the best way to follow my work is through my Substack newsletter. It's called Interruptions. And the address is steelcs, so steelecs.substack.com. You can also find me on Instagram, which is interruptions INTER with a long dash, RUPTIONS. I think I spelled that right. But yeah. Or on Twitter, SteelCS. I mean, that's mainly where I talk to professors.
Amazing. But, well, Cameron, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and sharing all of this with me.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl underscore, that's BIRDGERHL underscore, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.